Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Federalism and Separation of Powers Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, September 27, 2017, during a live teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's teleforum conference call, as today we discuss recent developments in the President's travel moratorium. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, we're recording the call for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to sort through all the recent developments in the sort of history of the travel moratorium. We're pleased to welcome back to Teleforum Professor Josh Blackman. He's an associate professor of law at South Texas College of Law in Houston, Texas. I hope you did well through the hurricane down there, Josh, but look forward to your comments. With that, the floor is yours, Professor Blackman.
Thank you so much, Dean. It's a pleasure to be talking with everyone today. My goal is to give you a summary in maybe 20 minutes about the history of the travel moratorium case, that is Trump versus Iraq and Trump versus Hawaii. I want to do this in about five parts. First, I want to walk you through the history of the travel ban, including statements that then-candidate Trump made, as well as statements made by now-President Trump. Second, I want to discuss the contents of the three executive orders that have been issued, two of which were halted by the courts. Third, I want to discuss whether Congress has afforded the president the statutory authority to take these actions from a separation of powers perspective. Fourth, I want to discuss whether these actions conflict with the First Amendment, namely the Establishment Clause. And finally, I want to give you a preview of what the Supreme Court will do with this case whenever it gets to oral argument. So we really have to begin this discussion back in December of 2015, when candidate Trump called for a, quote, total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States until our country's representatives can figure out what is going on. Over the next few months, Trump shifted his position from a Muslim ban and moved toward what he called extreme vetting of people seeking entry to the United States from certain territories. Or did he? During a July 2016 interview on CBS's 60 Minutes, Trump told Leslie Stahl that you can call it whatever you want. We'll call it territories. Was that a repudiation or not? A week later, Meet the Press, Trump seemed to clearly repudiate the old policy. He said, "I'm talking territory instead of Muslim." Did he mean it? Alas, the burden of reconciling these statements has shifted from fact checkers to the federal courts. And beginning with the inauguration, federal judges in Virginia, in Hawaii, in Maryland, and elsewhere looked to these statements made by President Trump on TV before the inauguration as proof that Trump's policies are infected by animus. But let's actually move on till after the inauguration. On January 27th, about a week after the president took the oath, the first executive order was issued. This one sent shockwaves through a legal order. For 90 days, certain aliens from Iraq, Iran, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, Syria, and Yemen were deemed detrimental to American interests, and so they were denied entry to the United States. Also, for a period of 120 days, the refugee admission program was suspended. Syrian refugees in particular will be denied entry indefinitely. Almost immediately after the order was signed, it was signed on a Friday, airport officials began to detain nationals in those seven nations, and what I've dubbed the airport cases. Judges in New York, Virginia, Washington, Massachusetts, and elsewhere promptly ordered their release. But these emergency proceedings were only the beginning of the lawfare. On March 6, 2017, President Trump issued a second executive order on immigration that superseded his first order. This order removed Iraq from the list and made clear that lawful permanent residents, that is, green card holders, were not subject to the bans. Rather than quantifying whether aliens from these countries engage in terrorist acts, which is always the wrong question, new findings instead established that the United States lacked sufficient diplomatic relations with these six nations to trust their screening mechanisms. For example, Iran and Syria do not cooperate with the United States in counterterrorism efforts at all. Libya, Somalia, and Sudan provide some level of cooperation, Yemen has been supportive of these efforts, but has not been fully able to cooperate. Iraq, which was on the first list, was excluded in light of our government's close cooperative relation with its ally. This order was also challenged in the courts immediately, and federal judges in Maryland and Hawaii invalidated it. Ultimately, the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that it was unconstitutional in that the president's anti-Muslim animus tainted this policy. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in California took a slightly different ruling, and they said it was a violation of statutory law, that is, the president didn't have the authority under Congress's laws to deny entry to this class of aliens. Over the summer of 2017, this case went back and forth to the Supreme Court on three occasions over a fairly minute issue of who should be allowed in during the interim of this case. There was a lot of litigation over who was a close enough relative. What if you were a U.S. citizen with a grandmother in Syria? Was that a close relative? And how much of a relationship must a refugee have to an American, what's called a resettlement agency, to be allowed in? This litigation went back and forth in a series of orders. But we all knew it was coming, which was what happens after 90 days, right? When the 90-day mark hit, which was this past Sunday, President Trump issued a third order. This was not an order, it was a presidential proclamation, to be precise. And in this order, the Department of Homeland Security created a baseline for every country in the world to meet that measured every country's performance about how much information was being shared. This is what's called identity management, right? So if someone's coming here with a passport that says their name is John Smith, are they actually John Smith? Can we be certain that that's a valid document? During the initial review, 16 countries were found to be deficient, with 31 others found to be at risk of becoming deficient. The Secretary of State thereafter engaged with the countries reviewed in an effort to address deficiencies. This process was successful. Many countries were found to be improved, and they were dropped off this list. Ultimately, the Secretary of Homeland Security concluded that a small number of countries, there were seven of them, did not meet the standards the government set out. The seven countries are Chad, Iran, Libya, North Korea, Syria, Venezuela, and Yemen. So one country dropped off the list from the second ban, that was Sudan. Sudan is not on the policy anymore, but added are Chad, North Korea, and Venezuela. There's some debate about how much the addition of Venezuela and North Korea adds. There are not many aliens coming from North Korea, and the Venezuelan ban primarily refers to government officials. So for all intents and purposes, Chad is the only country that has any significance, and the people of Chad seem to be quite surprised by this order. So almost immediately after President Trump signed this new proclamation, the Solicitor General, who's now Noel Francisco, he was confirmed fairly recently, sent a letter to the Supreme Court, and Francisco asked the court to order a new round of briefing to consider the effect of this latest proclamation on the litigation. Now, the court had scheduled oral arguments for October 10th, about 2 weeks from now. Almost immediately after that, the court took the October 10th date off the calendar, so there will not be arguments in this case coming up. And they submitted a round of briefing to ask people, is this case moot? That is, should the case be considered? Which brings me to the next part of my talk, right? Here we are, roughly 8 months after the first policy was enacted, and there's a distinct chance that despite countless briefs filed, countless appeals to the Supreme Court, they may never reach the merits. So the first question I want to talk about is mootness, right? Do the justices want to simply dump this case, or do they want to keep it? And I'm really of two minds here. The Roberts Court is perhaps most known for its minimalism. This is Chief Justice Roberts' calling card, so to speak. And I'm sure they would want to do everything in their power to avoid a major, major separation of powers ruling by just getting rid of the policy. But the hesitancy here is you're not getting rid of the case. This will go back down to the district courts in Hawaii and Maryland, and the judges there will probably issue similar rulings and say that this policy is still unconstitutional. So the justices will have to deal with this sooner rather than later, which is why I suspect the justices may just want to keep the case now. So far on three occasions, the justices have pushed back on the Ninth Circuit for going too far. And in my own personal opinion, the courts of appeals have not behaved well with these cases. In fact, the only forum where the Trump administration has had a fair shake has been the Supreme Court. Notice there were no lawsuits filed in the Fifth Circuit or the Eighth Circuit. So what I expect to happen, truly, is that the justices keep the case. They may not argue in October. Maybe they'll argue in December or January, and then proceed to actually figure out what to do. However, even if they decide to toss the case on mootness, the question is, what do you do with the previous decisions from the Fourth and Ninth Circuits? There's a doctrine called Munsingware, which sounds like an undergarment, but it's this old doctrine which says if a case becomes moot while it's on appeal, the court vacates the lower court ruling. But there's certain exceptions to the Munsingware doctrine where if the party's at fault for the mootness, it doesn't apply. So if the government takes a step to moot a case, they can't benefit from vacating the adverse decision. Whether or not this is a proper application of Munsingware, I would hope the court just vacates the Fourth and Ninth Circuit decisions. These are very, very extreme cases where they abandon longstanding precedents in terms of deference to the executive. They leapfrogged over the question of whether the Establishment Clause even applies to foreign policy. They made a number of errors which I've documented at length. So I hope at a minimum we can start from scratch. Okay. Next, I'd like to move on to the actual arguments in terms of the statutory position and in terms of the Constitution itself. The key statute which President Trump has now relied on several times is 8 U.S.C. 1182F, and this was enacted back in the 1950s. And it gives the president the power to suspend the entry of all aliens or any class of aliens that he may deem to be appropriate, right? So if the president makes a finding that a certain class of aliens is detrimental to American interests, he can deny their entry. In terms of delegations to the president, this is a really broad one. There are not many strings. This is a president, I think this is Congress reaffirming the president's inherent power and doubling it up in terms of Justice Jackson's framework in Youngstown. The president has the power to deny entry. Congress is reaffirming it with the statute, and there's not much refining that's been made, only one of detrimentality. And I think the president has done this. I don't think you need to have a case-by-case basis for adjudication of someone's dangerous. That's never been required. So the Ninth Circuit erred in saying he lacked the statutory authority. Now, there's another statutory argument that I want to mention. In the famous Immigration Act of 1967, Congress passed a statute saying that the government can't discriminate with respect to the issuance of visas based on nationality. This was to get rid of the quota system that plagued our immigration system for decades on end. There's one major distinction here. 1182F concerns denial of entry, and the 67 Act concerns the issuance of visas. The prior travel ban did not reflect a denial of a visa. They said you cannot enter. Even in fact, in the latest proclamation, no visas will be revoked. If you have your visa, you can keep it. If your healthcare plan, I suppose. If you like your visa, you can keep your visa. But the issue here is they won't be given new visas. And I think the statute there still permits the denial of visa based on national security rationales. And I don't think that's a nationality-based distinction. I think there's a legitimate reason why. So I don't see a statutory problem with this case, although the Ninth Circuit did go down that road. The argument that's gotten a lot more attention and a lot more emphasis was the First Amendment. And this is the argument that President Trump's actions are tainted by animus. And it's not really an equal protection argument. They fashion it as an Establishment Clause position, but it's really due process, that this national security policy lacks minimum rationality because it's infected by this hatred of Muslims. And there are two ways that they've established this animus. They've said, first, look to the president's statements going back on the campaign trail. Second, look to his statements after the inauguration, as well as statements made by his associates, like Rudy Giuliani. Okay, so as a threshold matter, I don't think campaign statements are fair game. There is zero precedent to saying that for any court to say that you can look to campaign statements when you're defining the intent of the president. When the president takes the oath of office, it's like a baptism, right? I think it does have a cleansing effect, and you start with a blank slate. So those campaign statements, I think, are frankly out. And I don't think the justices want a ruling that says you look at campaign statements, because Trump, in his many, many months on the trail, has offended virtually everyone. And if we take the position that if he offended you on the campaign trail, you can use that in court, the president becomes crippled very quickly. look to the litigation in New York about DACA. Statements he made to Jorge Ramos now are being used to say he hates Hispanics, and this is why the DACA rescission is unconstitutional. So let's move on to the post-inauguration statements, right? What were the statements made following January 20th? Here, I think the statements can be used in general. I've written at length that courts can look to the president's statements. But under the prevailing rule of the case called Kleindienst versus Mandel from the 1970s, the review of these decisions of the executive branch is limited to the face of the policy, facial legitimacy and bona fide. And I think facial modifies both of those words. You can't look behind the curtain when someone's denied entry to the United States. You have to look at the face of the policy, and the face of the policy is here neutral. So I think the president's statements aren't relevant in this context. Even if they were relevant, I don't think they're dispositive. The statements Trump made after the inauguration, thankfully, are far more benign. He didn't actually say anything about hating Muslims or wanting to keep Muslims out. He was more circumspect. The best evidence they have is Trump saying when he signed the order, "We all know what this means, right?" Well, if you actually watch the video, he was speaking in front of Vice President Pence and Secretary Mattis. They were talking for 5 minutes about fighting terrorism. It's really obvious what he meant. He was talking about fighting terrorism and keeping us safe. Whether or not that happens, I couldn't tell you. But it wasn't talking about, you know, keeping Muslims out. So I don't think the post-inauguration evidence is fair game. And even if it is fair game, I don't think it's admissible. And I don't think it proves the point. Now, let's assume that it is admissible and it proves the point. Does this violate the Establishment Clause? There is zero precedent whatsoever in the book, zero, for the proposition that our domestic Establishment Clause applies to immigration law. There's none. It doesn't exist. In fact, we have elements of our immigration law that are expressly bound up in religion. You know, do you know, for example, that we have a statute that gives preference to ministers for visas, that if you want to emigrate to the United States and you're a pastor, you get special treatment? That would never fly in the United States, but we do it abroad. We actually had a statute in the book for decades that gives special treatment to Soviet Jews and evangelical Christians. It says it right in the statute, Soviet Jews and evangelical Christians. Again, that would not work domestic, but we have it in immigration law. Much of asylum law and refugee law is premised on religion, and judges have to make very tough calls about a person's faith, and those faith decisions would not be allowed in a domestic context. So I think in every respect, the immigration law should not be subjected to the Establishment Clause, which leaves us again with the Due Process Clause. Is there a minimum rational basis for the president's actions? As a matter of policy, I don't agree with any of these travel bans. I think they're all very stupid. I don't think they'll do much to keep us safe. But the standard here is rational basis, a test I don't very much like, but that's a test we have here. If the government puts out a 20-page document which lists a country-by-country analysis that they performed, that goes beyond rationality of anything any court will ever uphold. If the courts start applying what amounts to strict scrutiny to the president's national security determinations, our polity looks to be a very different place, which, to circle back to my first point, this may be why the Supreme Court keeps the case. The adults are here in the room. They can supervise the inferior judges and settle this matter, perhaps not once and for all, but at least put the legal resistance in their place. So I thank you very much, Dean. I will wait to take some questions and hope there's some interest on the line.
Well, thank you. That was a very comprehensive recounting of where we've been and where we are. Let's open the floor to questions. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for our expert, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are wide open. While we wait to see who might ring in, let me make a quick announcement about our upcoming schedule. Our next scheduled Teleform conference calls 2 p.m. tomorrow Eastern Time at this same number. We'll be talking about the authorization for the use of military force. It's a debate with Professors Robert Turner and Professor Stephen Vladek, talking about whether or not the AUMF needs to be updated sort of as a legal matter, and I guess they'll get into some policy questions. Today, of course, We're talking about the immigration moratorium. Push the star button, then the pound button. If you have a question for our experts, our lines are open. Let me start off by asking you a question, if I could. You mentioned animus, the president's animus in signing this. I suppose that's becoming more and more attenuated as you know we spend time from pre-campaign statements to post-convention statements to post-election statements to post-inauguration statements. How does the attenuation figure into this? That's one question, and I guess the second question might be. We talked about this sort of in a pre-call, the Blaine amendments. If you could explain those and maybe speculate and work through those a little bit, those were amendments that were, I think, adopted by many of the states over 100 years ago with a decidedly anti-Catholic animus, and I think opponents of those have certainly argued that in court. So two more issues you might want to touch on.
Sure, Dean. I appreciate the question. So the first part of your question is about animus, and this is a word that's not in the Constitution, but the courts have inserted into case law. That is, if an action which might be facially neutral is motivated by a bad reasoning or a bad motivation, courts can actually step in to invalidate it. Here we have a situation where Trump made some really awful statements in the campaign trail. He did. He then walked them back, whether you believe it or not, he did walk them back. And then since the inauguration, he hasn't made those sorts of statements. Is everything he does that affects Muslims going to be tainted by that initial argument, right, that initial campaign promise? I think the answer has to be no. There's a case called McCreary County versus ACLU, which considers the Ten Commandments display at the courthouse in Kentucky. And there what you had was three successive displays involving the Ten Commandments. And each one became more and more religious. They basically increased the religious religiosity of each display. And the court said, look, you know, we're not dumb, right? We know what's going on. There's a sequence of events. They're basically not trying to hide the ball. But we have here with the travel ban is something quite different. You have three orders now, three successive orders. Each one gets less and less religious. The first order had a reference to religious minorities, not Christians, but religious minorities. The second order had this reference to honor killings, which I think was a mistake, but that was left in there. The third order has none of that, and it was performed following a 3-month review of 200 countries in the world. So I think at this point, the argument for attenuation from Trump's initial campaign statements are quite strong. Now, you mentioned the Blaine Amendments. That's actually a good example. These were various forms, either statutes or state constitutional amendments enacted sometimes over 100 years ago that denies funding to religious institutions. And we may say, hey, wow, that's great, the Establishment Clause. Well, no. These were mostly enacted out of a bias towards Catholics. So I think what you had there is an animus behind these amendments. To my knowledge, Dean, maybe I'm wrong, someone can correct me, there's been no evidence that any courts ever struck down a Blaine Amendment pursuant to the argument of animus. And actually, I just realized I got the ordering in McCreary backwards. They didn't become more religious, they became less religious, right? But the same motivation there applied. Whereas with the Trump thing, I think there's a credible case that there's a very different motivation from each excessive order. So I apologize. I got the people are texting me while I'm on the line, which I appreciate to fact check me where I can.
Very good. Once again, our lines are open. If you have a question for Professor Josh Blackman, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got one question now. So let's turn to our first caller.
I wondered why Korematsu versus the United States wasn't controlling in this case. Isn't essentially the question whether the courts run the immigration system in this country or whether the president does?
Well, I thank you for the question. I think Korematsu is very relevant in a different way. Korematsu involved U.S. citizens who are being detained, and they have due process rights.
not all of them were citizens. They weren't all citizens. I mean, that's
you're
the
right.
Ruling
but Korematsu was. Fred Korematsu was a U.S. citizen, and he was being detained without due process rights. So it's certainly true. The aliens at issue here aren't U.S. citizens. They're people outside the United States. Granted, they have U.S. relatives in some cases, but they themselves are not citizens.
Right.
But it's not enough. I think Korematsu is a rhetorical point that the plaintiffs are trying to assert here, that if the court upholds this, they're upholding, you know, the worst thing since Dred Scott. President Reagan in the 80s used the same statute to deny entry to Cubans after one of the tiffs with Fidel Castro and Noam Bad and Eyelash. This has been used to deny entry to Haitian, the boat people, right? Haitians, Noam Bad and Eyelash. It's only because of President Trump and the whole thing surrounding President Trump that this has come up the way it has. Had the government not issued Executive Order 1.0 and they just waited a few months and went to Executive Order 3.0, it would have been bulletproof. The problem was they started this off with this, you know, Friday night release with, you know, not much vetting to the public, and people got trapped at airports. And that was, I think, a bad rollout. But I think they've recovered, and I think this latest order should survive.
We've got another caller on the line with a question. If you'd like to join the queue, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another call.
Hey, Josh, it's Paul Salamanca at UK.
Hey, Paul.
Thank
By
you.
By the way, I should know, Paul is the person who texted me to say I got the ordering in McCreary County wrong, so I'm very grateful for my good friend's correction.
Well, it's just a few counties from where I am now, so I almost have personal knowledge of it. I wanted to ask you a question about the Establishment Clause and the Water's Edge rule. As you know, oftentimes when the Army is operating in foreign countries and we're taking advantage of religious divisions or avoiding religious strife as part of the military grand strategy, we very definitely do take into account people's religious affinities and so on. And arguably that implicates the Establishment Clause, although in a kind of crazy way. I'm wondering two things. One, might that be something the court might rely on in saying the Establishment Clause really does end at the water's edge? Or two, might it be a predicate for the court to try to pretermit these questions and simply say, this is not a religious distinction, we don't reach the question of the Establishment Clause? Thanks.
I think the answer is yes and yes. I don't think the court wants to make a ruling one way or the other on the effect of the Establishment Clause on foreign policy decisions. These are very difficult cases. I mean, we have asylum judges, I mean, immigration judges making asylum calls that require very deep probing into the tenets of faith and sincerity and sorts of inquiries that an Article III judge never would. If we start taking the position that this violates the Establishment Clause, a lot of things start going into muck. So I think Paul's second option may even make more sense. Just say, we're not going to reach this issue simply to say that under our reading of the third executive order, it does not implicate religion. Done. I think that might be the safest way of avoiding that really tough question.
Thanks, Josh.
Thank you, Paul.
Once again, our lines are wide open. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. I'll fill the gap in here for a minute. You mentioned, Professor Blackman, what the court might or might not want to do going forward, the U.S. Supreme Court, that is. It sort of seems to me that, you know, with a new proclamation, the other executive orders are mooted. They're no longer in effect, I assume. Can the Supreme Court, hear this case without the record being developed by lower courts? Is it the same case? Is it a brand new case? What really are the options of the court? And sort of the second part of this question, what is your sense of what the government wants in this case?
So let me answer the second part first. The government, I think, has done a fantastic job. So now Noel Francisco is confirmed, but Jeff Wall, who is the acting SG, was guiding the ship for, you know, some time. I think he did a really good job of pacing the case. And I say that because the government held the keys. They were driving this car. And they knew that once that 90 days period lapsed, they would give their own executive order, this new proclamation that would perhaps wipe out the case. Now, I don't know what the government wants, right? The easy answer is, oh, the government wants to avoid a Supreme Court ruling because the government always wants to avoid a decision from the Supreme Court and the separation of powers, better leave things open, right? But the other argument is, what's the advantage of going back to the Ninth Circuit? You know what they're going to do. There's no mystery. They're going to rule against Trump, right? There's not a mystery here. They've done it over and over again, and on three occasions, the Supreme Court has pushed back. Maybe there's an advantage to letting the Supreme Court issue a ruling in favor of the government. The fact that we've had three stays from the Supreme Court tells me that Justice Kennedy on three occasions has said, okay, Trump has some merit. And when Justice Kennedy issues a stay, he ultimately reverses in almost every case. I've done the math on this. So there may be an advantage to just keeping it here and ruling for the court. Now, can the justices issue a ruling without a developed record? Of course they can. They can do whatever they want. You know, that might occasion a bitter dissenting. This should have been remanded, you know, and developed a full record. Well, they've asked for more briefing on it. The case will be fully briefed. So I think if the justices want to issue a ruling, they can. If they want to remand and vacate, they can. So a lot will depend on what happens after this next round of briefing, which should be fairly brief, no pun intended, and they'll either dismiss the case as improvidently granted, or they'll vacate and remand the lower court decisions. And which of those options will make a big difference? I should note that last year there was a case involving the Gloucester County case, GG, the transgender bathroom case. After the Trump administration changed policies, the court vacated and remanded the Fourth Circuit. They didn't just dig the case. So that perhaps provides one precedent of what happens going forward.
Once again, if you have a question, we've got some time left. Push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got plenty of people on the line. I don't know if you've said it, but I think it's the case that Justice Kennedy is the justice assigned to the Ninth Circuit, so he's the one that's been hearing these requests for he's been granting these stays. Is that right? Can you say a few more words about that?
Right. So the general process, when the Solicitor General seeks a stay from the Ninth Circuit, it goes to Justice Kennedy, and then he refers it to the full court. What happens after that is something of a mystery. On three occasions, the justices have issued stays with no recorded dissents. That is, none of the liberal justices said, no, don't do this. But the mere fact that a justice doesn't dissent from an order does not mean that they all agree to it. It's one of these weird aspects of these unsigned opinions. The lack of a dissent does not mean unanimity. So it's entirely possible that some of the liberal justices disagreed, but they didn't signal it. But again, I've looked back the last decade since Roberts joined the court. When Justice Kennedy votes to issue a stay, in almost every case, he votes to reverse on the merits, right? Conversely, when Justice Kennedy grants a stay, when he denies a stay, that means he probably agrees with the lower court. So that's an important distinction.
Interesting. The language you cited, the statutory language you cited, refers to the president's authority here and says that he may do this or that by proclamation. And you've drawn a distinction, or you've noted a distinction, I guess, between the first two actions here, which were executive orders in January and then March, and then the most recent, which is a proclamation. Did they call this a proclamation to sort of hew to the text of this statute? Is there a big difference between a proclamation and an executive order?
Well, there's not really a difference. And in fact, this has been one of the topics of conversation in the admin law prof. Listserv. Even the first order used the word proclaim, and the second order used the word proclaim. So I think the White House lawyers were aware of this issue, but by calling this a proclamation, it fits neatly into the confines of the of 8 U.S.C. 1182F. I don't think it makes a difference. If the president issued this on a cocktail napkin, it would have the same legal effect. It's a statement by the president with a signature on it. It has all the weight of the commander-in-chief behind it, regardless of its form. But I will note that this document is a lot tighter than the very first document, which had a lot to be desired. And I think the government lawyers here engage in a legitimate good faith effort to implement the executive's policies in a way that was explained. I didn't go through the specifics, but if you read through it, there's a country by country breakdown. It's not just all people from these countries are denied. It's these people with this category of visas can come. Those visas have other restrictions. If you want to come here on a permanent visa, you can't. So there was actually, as far as we can tell, and we don't have access to the classified record, As far as we can tell, they made good faith efforts to ascertain which countries were and were not sharing information. And one other point, Dean, this is not permanent. A lot of the media saying this is a permanent ban. The order says it should be revisited every 180 days. So it's entirely possible that maybe in 6 months, Chad comes off the list. Will Syria come off the list in 6 months? Unlikely. Will Iran, a state sponsor of terror, come off the list in 6 months? Unlikely. But it's entirely conceivable that countries that play ball can.
Right. And it's country by country that's going to be revisited each 180 days.
Exactly. Each country on the list is revisited. And it's even possible countries can be added to the list. It's not a fixed, you know, fixed body.
Right. Very good. And the statutory language doesn't have a time limit, or does it?
No, it doesn't. No, it doesn't. It has no time limit, nor is there any burden of proof, right? It doesn't say the president must demonstrate with clear and convincing evidence that they're detrimental. It says they may be detrimental, right? Let me get the exact language.
Would be detrimental. I think it says would be.
I'm sorry. Not would be. I'm sorry. It would be detrimental. That's a pretty capacious standard about what they're delegating for. And again, I've been making this argument for some time. And if you read the amicus brief of the Texas Solicitor General and a number of other states that joined Texas, this brings us back to Youngstown and the Still Future case. There's a situation here where I think the president has the inherent power to deny entry to people he deems dangerous. So if the statute was never enacted, I think the order would be on not as good footing, but decent footing, right? But we have a statute reaffirming the president's inherent power to deny entry to people he deems dangerous. It's not about giving people immigration paperwork. It's about stopping people at the border, which is where the executive's power is at zenith. So you have the Congress giving the statute, you have the president's own power. Here, the scope of judicial review, if you listen to Justice Jackson, I think it's at its absolute minimum because you have all branches of the government coordinating. Now, does 1182F give the president too much power? I tend to think it does. I would actually be considered, you know, revising 1182F a bit, which might change his calculus. But so long as the statute's in the books, the president has his power.
Very good. Once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We do have another question from the audience, so let's head in a new direction here.
Hi, this is Corey Liu. Do you think with how aggressively courts are going after the president, that it's possible that if this kind of dispute continues and courts keep going after him and citing campaign remarks and things like that, that the president might just choose to not follow what the court has said? And I know there's some scholarly discussion about sort of, you know, maybe the president has his own authority to interpret the Constitution, and, you know, perhaps this president might at some point just decide to go with what he thinks is in the interest of security and foreign affairs, which is typically what's in the president's domain, and that's kind of why traditionally courts have deferred. But do you think that's possible, and what do you think would be the consequences?
You know, it's scary. You're the second person to ask me that today, a reporter asking that question a couple hours ago. So it's definitely on people's minds. Look, so I've been extremely critical of the judiciary. I've called this the legal resistance. I've called this a judicial panic. The sorts of opinions we've seen from these courts are, I think, inexcusable. The president has a statutory authority, a constitutional authority. At least pretend this is a close call. Don't cite an interview on Fox News with Rudy Giuliani as proof that the president is acting with animus. Judges should know better than this. They really should. Now, the question that Corey posed is, what if the courts keep ruling against Trump and Trump says, you know what, I'm the president, I take an oath to the Constitution, I'm interpreting, I mean, I can do this, come and get it. And it's a lesson I often teach my students, right? So there's a famous case called Ex Parte Merriman. In this case involved during the Civil War, the Union Army took a prisoner, a guy named Merriman, and they held him at Fort McHenry, which is in Baltimore. And somehow somehow Merriman swore a habeas corpus writ to Roger Taney, who was the Chief Justice. He was in the Circuit Court of Maryland, unclear of status. Read Seth Barrett Tillman's article on this. But the important point is, at one point, Taney ordered his marshal to go to the court and basically arrest the general and say, bring the body here. So you can imagine this lowly marshal, right, the clerk of the court, going and knocking on Fort McHenry saying, please come out. And they ignored him. And that instance at once illustrates how weak the judiciary is. As Hamilton said in Federal 78, they don't have the power of the sword, they don't have the power of the purse, they have only the power of their will and their judgment. And their edicts are followed because they're deemed legitimate, but that legitimacy is not unlimited. Now, I don't think we're even remotely close to the period where people should start ignoring opinions. But that you asked about and the reporter asked about as well tells me that there's this sense of frustration, and I hope we don't go down that road. I think it will be far worse. I'd much rather these judges issue these poor rulings and Trump follow them than the opposite.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button. Our lines are again wide open. I'll ask a follow-up question, if I could, Professor Blackmon, sort of related to the previous question. And can you talk a little bit about when, under what circumstances, a single district court judge can enjoin, enjoin an action throughout the entire country? I mean, we've seen this late in the Obama administration with regard to President Obama's immigration policies. We've seen it now in the Trump administration. What are the rules there? It's an interesting sort of confrontation between a president or maybe the legislature and one district court judge.
So I encourage you, actually, Sam Bray, who's a law professor at UCLA, has a post in the Vol Consultory about this from today or yesterday. Read that for sure. But I'll give you a brief summary. Traditionally, the notion of injunction is you're binding the parties in a case. So, Bob sues Sally, the injunction binds Bob and Sally. But there's a different question of when the federal government is the defendant. Can the federal government be enjoined in only the district where they're sued or nationwide? So during the latter years of the Obama administration, there was a fairly effective strategy where conservative attorneys general brought suits usually in districts in Texas where the judiciary was somewhat conservative, and they sought orders blocking President Obama's immigration policy, various financial policies, Title IX, various rules involving Obamacare. And the norm became, you have these massive coalitions of states suing and seeking not just a limited injunction, but an injunction nationwide. And the argument is, well, if it's illegal, the president can't do it anywhere. I think as a matter of course, the courts have this authority. It's somewhat novel, but it became an accepted wisdom. And to the surprise of no one, after the change in administrations, now you had liberal states, New York, Hawaii, et cetera, suing for nationwide injunctions. And in the travel ban case, you've had court after court. Sam Bray, in the Vol quote they mentioned, makes an astute point. The Supreme Court hasn't weighed in on this. They haven't. And at some point, I think the justices probably will weigh in and ask, can you really have these lower court judges making decisions with national effect? We, the Supreme Court, are involved in this country, right? We make the national rulings. You lowly inferior judge, you have your district in Brownsville or your district in Honolulu, and that's all you can govern. So I think at some point the court may intervene here. And I'll make this one extra point. The effect of these nationwide injunctions is the need for more emergency stays. Because if you just have a district court injunction in Brownsville, Texas, you know, who cares? But when you have an injunction nationwide, you run up to the Court of Appeals, and that doesn't work, you run up to the Supreme Court. So because of this trend of nationwide injunctions, the justices have been much more involved, and they may or may not like that.
It's a fascinating point. There's a somewhat related, I suppose, doctrine. There's a doctrine of non-acquiescence that I've seen used by the National Labor Relations Board and the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, where they bring a case, not for an injunction, but they bring a case against an employer in one circuit after another and lose the case there. The winner, of course, doesn't seek cert from a circuit court case they've won, but the EEOC and the NLRB find that they're not bound anywhere else other beyond those circuits. So there's some interesting disparities there, I suppose.
Yeah, so the issue of non-acquiescence, actually I'd encourage you to read an issue of the Tulane Law Review. The editor-in-chief that year was a guy named Bill Pryor, and it includes entries from Ed Meese and others discussing this non-acquiescence doctrine. I've started researching it at some length because of what's going on now, but the Reagan administration long had a policy where they said, if we get an adverse ruling in the Fourth Circuit and we're litigating a case in the Fifth Circuit, we're just going to ignore it. And you know, the plaintiff groups went crazy saying, how can you do this? It's like Cooper v. Aaron, you're ignoring the courts. And they said, well, we're only in the circuit that we're bound. Although with some of the federal agencies where there's only appeal to the D.C. circuit, and so basically the district courts there, they're fine to follow it. I mean, Dean mentioned it, so I think we may see some non-acquiescence coming in. I don't think we'll see full-blown ignoring the courts, but you may see shreds of non-acquiescence. I'll give you another Obamacare-related story. A couple years ago, you may recall a case called King v. Burwell, which involved a challenge to the Affordable Care Act of whether subsidies be paid out in a federal exchange that was not established by the state. And the Obama administration put in a ruling to the D.C. Circuit, a brief, where they basically said very quietly that any ruling the D.C. Circuit issues only affects the named plaintiffs. That is, if there are six or seven people who challenge Obamacare, even if they won, the Obama administration would only apply the judgment to them. And then Mike Carvin and Jones Day was representing the plaintiff. They followed this brief saying, what are you, insane? And the D.C. Circuit dismissed it out of hand. But even then, we saw an administration willing to narrow the scope of judgment in what's effectively non-acquiescence. It didn't go anywhere, but we may see that soon. But go check out the prior issue of the Tulane Law Review back from the 1980s.
Fascinating stuff. Let me make a final call for questions. If you have a question, now's the time. Push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Professor Blackman, I think we've had our final question. Let me give you a minute or two to wrap up or express a final thought.
Well, I appreciate the time to speak to everyone today. What I'd ask for you all to keep in mind is put aside your own personal feelings of the travel ban, indeed President Trump, when you look at these sorts of issues. I, as a libertarian, I find myself in disagreement with virtually everything he does nowadays. It's an odd spot. But try to do what Justice Scalia did in Texas versus Johnson, right? This is a flag-burning case. Even if you hate flag burners, still remember that they have the right to burn the flag or perhaps take a knee. Likewise, even if you disagree with the president's immigration policies, take a careful look at the statute, a careful look at the case law, and then come to a conclusion that's not driven by whatever the vicissitudes of the day are.
Well, Professor Josh Blackman, thank you so much for joining us. We certainly appreciate it. We look forward to having you back on Teleforum and who knows what matter in the future. I want to thank the audience as well for dialing in. We certainly appreciate your time and your attention and your questions. A reminder to the audience about our next scheduled Teleforum conference call tomorrow at 2 p.m. at this same number. We'll be talking about the AUMF. We'll be debating it, in fact. But until the next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this practice group.